I'm Mark Steiner, once again here with Secretary Ray Skinner, of course, Secretary of Housing and Community Development, who joins us here every week to talk about what those of us who may be in trouble with our mortgages can do. And Ray, good to see you once again in our studios.
Mark, it's always a pleasure.
Now, when a family is really facing foreclosure for the first time, what we say over and over again, these little promos we do with you all, is call that number. Call the Hope Counseling Network right away to save you and your house.
Actually, Mark, the first thing that we advise homeowners to do when they're in trouble is really to contact their lender or servicer. More than likely, the lender or servicer has been trying to contact you. But many times, as you know, people are afraid to pick up the phone, right, afraid to open their mail. So the first thing we emphasize is tell people to contact their lender, return the phone calls, take the phone calls, and open their mail. Because the lender really doesn't want to take your house, but they're trying to get in contact with you. So you have to engage. Secondly, we encourage people to call our HOPE hotline, which is 1-877-462-7555. When they call that number, they're directed to one of our HOPE housing counseling advisors. And these counselors are trained to work with families who are in trouble and to really be their advocate in working with the lender or servicer. They're familiar with all of the various options, various programs. As many of your listeners probably know, there's a federal program called HAMP, Home Affordability Modification Program, or HAMP. This is the Obama administration's effort to try to help people to get loan modifications. So when you talk to one of the counselors, they can advise you on whether you're eligible for the HAMP. And they also have good relationships with most of the lenders and servicers, particularly the larger servicing companies, where they can go directly to somebody in that company that they can work with and help homeowners to modify their loan.
So do you literally become the advocate for the people who are holding their mortgage? I mean, for the citizens? Is that what you're doing in this process?
Right. The housing counselor really becomes the advocate for the person who is behind in their mortgage. And they've been trained, literally trained, to be able to negotiate with the lender or servicer. And since we started this program in 2007, I believe, we've literally helped over 51,000 homeowners here in Maryland. We've counseled 51,000 homeowners, and we now think about 14,000 of those have resulted in what we call a positive outcome. In most cases, they're able to stay in their home. But the reality is everybody's not going to be able to stay in their home for a number of reasons, particularly if they're unemployed or don't have income. They're not going to be able to sustain the mortgage. So the home counselors are also trained in how to help folks find a graceful exit if they, in fact, have to leave through a short sale or some other means like that.
And that number again is?
The number again is 1-877-462-7555. Or you can go to our website, which is www.mdhope.org.
Secretary Skinner, once again, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome to Bus Boys and Poets. We're here this evening with David Swanson, who has written the book War is a Lie. We are broadcasting for the Mark Steiner Show, the Center for Emerging Media, for Free Speech TV, down here at 5th and K at Bus Boys and Poets. David was on our show recently by phone, and we thought it more important to see each other face-to-face once again. He was on our election night coverage at Bus Boys and Poets, the other location. And we're here with a live audience, and we welcome all of you as well. And let you know, we have a roving mic in the audience, so you can participate in this conversation, because we want you involved in this. And David, good to see you. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks, Mark.
So before we begin with the book, I think a good place to start is what you did yesterday, what happened at Quantico, and why you're here now as opposed to in the clutches of the United States Marines.
Yes. Well, Many of us went down to Quantico Marine Base yesterday, including many of you in the room here that I see, to protest the treatment of Bradley Manning, who, regardless of what you think of what he's accused of, has been kept in solitary confinement for 8 months without having been put on trial for anything, which is cruel and unusual and is admittedly unusual and it can amount to torture as well as clearly inhumane treatment. And so a lot of us actually believe the man is a hero. And yet this is part of the fundamental lies that are built into our understanding of war, this idea that someone who tells us about war crimes, when ordinarily to not point out a felony is itself a crime, that someone who does this is then himself a traitor. Well, we went down and we protested and we blocked the road at the entrance to Quantico Marine Base, and I took a video camera and asked some of the Marines questions, which is apparently, you know, an offensive act of, you know, we're criminalizing journalism. This was journalism. And at one point, a couple of these Marines started to grab me and pull me towards the base. And to all appearances, I was going to be thrown somewhere in the brig, probably not going to have the luck to be next door to Bradley and be able to talk to him. But
I doubt it.
but about 20 of our great peace activists grabbed me and pulled me back, and another one of whom, Tige Berry, was himself then grabbed and hauled away, and 10 or 20 people grabbed him back, and so no one was imprisoned, no one was hurt, and I think it's an excellent lesson, and it absolutely bewilders people who have been trained in blind obedience to see people act in a way that's absolutely contrary to what they've just been ordered. I think, you know, we weren't hostile with these Marines and these guards. We were asking them whether they were proud of defending locking people up for 8 months without trial, and I think the questions disturbed them because they know it's wrong.
One of the things Kevin said to me, Kevin Zeese I'm talking about, before we came in tonight, who was there with you at Quantico, along with Mark and Flowers and others that I know, was that I said to him, he said, he could have, Bradley could have, given those documents to Iran, to any government on the planet, but he chose instead to give them to Wikipedia, committing the crime of journalism. WikiLeaks. Wikipedia, we get lost forever. WikiLeaks. What?
He's alleged to have.
Alleged. But so, and I think that was an important distinction people also don't make, the government doesn't make. And you're right, what they are doing to him at the moment is tantamount to torture. In isolation, tortured in many ways, same way they did to people in Iran, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's also buried so deep that we never hear of it. Nobody covers the demonstrations. Nobody covers what's happening to him.
Yeah, he, you know, typically to witness felonies and not report them is a crime. He didn't do that. He also didn't try to make money off of this, which he could have made a fortune. Allegedly, what he's done, judging by his supposed comments in an online chat, was to try to make information public in what he thought of as a representative republic so that people would know what their government was doing. And it seems to have had quite an effect in places like Tunisia. And I think that if Americans were to read what has come out thus far, in addition to the video of collateral murder that he allegedly released, in which American troops shoot up a van with injured people in it, they would have a different reaction. It's when people are so ignorant of what has been put out there that they're willing to accept that someone who's just been named a traitor and they know nothing else about him is a traitor. I think most Americans, if they knew the facts, would sympathize with Bradley Manning. And I think that as Dan Ellsberg has become acceptable and respected, and as Dr. Martin Luther King has become so acceptable and respected, they now claim he would support the wars, I think that Bradley Manning will be a hero. I hope he just doesn't have to spend the intervening decades in a cell.
Well, as long as folks like you keep going there and we go keep going there and bringing it up, the attention will grow, and hopefully that'll make a huge difference. Let's come to your book, War is a Lie. And we said before we started this, we're going to give you a chance here to kind of, with the audience, before we begin, questions and answers from me and from the audience, is to kind of lay out your thesis about war is a lie.
Well, one idea behind writing the book was that, you know, the smart, informed people who were coming to me and telling me how outrageous the war on Iraq was, because for the first time ever a president had lied about a war, were spreading very damaging ideas, that in fact the lies that got us into Iraq are exactly typical, are very much like the lies that get us into any war. And that if you look at enough of these wars, U.S. wars and other wars, you can't find one that justifies the continuation of our war policies. And in fact, as the very worst thing that humanity has ever come up with, modern warfare ought to be dismissed in all cases. That is, you know, we don't talk about a good slavery or a just rape, but we all fantasize that maybe next month there will be a real war that's necessary and good. And if we understand that there can't be, then we begin to dismantle what Eisenhower 50 years ago yesterday called the military-industrial complex. It's this idea that we might have a good war, even if this one isn't it, that keeps that in place, which is itself a big source of momentum in generating wars. And so in the book, I go after the various claims, the various types of lies and deceptions that keep wars around and keep war policy around, and the ideas that aggressive wars are defensive, and the idea that wars can be humanitarian, and the idea that some people or some dictators are so evil that you just have to have a war. And I suggest that wars are not inevitable and are not justifiable, and that rather than having our State Department and our Justice Department and the rest of our government working for the war machine and planning potential scenarios for war anywhere at any time, we ought to be putting some resources into planning for the possibility of peace and using at least part of our government to work for peace. And that, in fact, it won't. This is not just an argument now about living better lives, although we could live vastly better lives if we shifted those resources. It's an argument about survival. We cannot survive another 50 years of advancing the military-industrial complex, not economically, not financially, not environmentally, not in terms of blowback or proliferation, not in terms of the stripping away of civil liberties and our representation in our government. We just cannot survive it. We have to end it.
So I think it's hard to argue that every war, hard not to argue, as you are arguing, that every war that, as you lay out in the book, from when you write about the Spanish-American War, and you wrote about World War I, and you wrote about World War II and the Civil War, and how each one of those began with lies. And I think that the history is irrefutable, that you, as you lay out, that those wars began with lies. Then there's the complexity people have to address that. I'll throw examples to talk about. Where do we want to start? Let's work our way backwards. We all knew Vietnam was like, I'll work my way back to Vietnam. In World War II, which is probably, World War II and the Civil War are probably the most difficult wars for people to wrestle with your analysis of what war means. And we talked about this before. World War II. You lay out in the book how Sinnott and his book and others exposed the Freedom of Information Act that Franklin Delano Roosevelt knew about the attack coming on Pearl Harbor. He wanted the attack on Pearl Harbor, right?
He did.
So tell that story a bit, and then let me ask you a question about that.
Well, it's not that attacking Pearl Harbor is defensible. It's not that Japan was not an imperial nation aggressively waging war. It's not that that isn't a horrendous crime. It's that our nation was a growing empire as well and very much wanted war and had come to see Japan much as we later came to see misguided disciples in Manuel Noriega or Saddam Hussein, people who were not countries that were not going to wage war on our behalf anymore, but were going to wage war on their own behalf, that were stepping out of line, that needed to be dealt with. You know, we had imposed modernity and warfare on Japan. We had tried to use Japan to our ends in the Pacific.
Right.
And when we, when our nation decided to go another route, we spent decades building up bases and airstrips around the Pacific and intentionally antagonizing Japan. And in the lead up to Pearl Harbor, taking steps, including economic sanctions and including waging war with China on Japan, sending planes and pilots to China, doing everything possible to have war with Japan, but have Japan make the first strike. And in fact, our government knew in great detail when and where that strike was coming and allowed it to happen and sacrificed those lives and that equipment in order to get into war. And historians who have researched this and written about it have in many cases justified it and said, well, Roosevelt had campaigned, lying as they always do, that he wouldn't take us into war. He couldn't very well take us into war without someone else attacking us first, so he had to have that happen so that he could get into war in Europe, where we had to get into war, you know, we had to be in the war in Europe. And so people justify the lies, which is such a perversion of the facts and of the idea of democracy and representative government. It's just inexcusable.
Now, same with World War II for a moment. And most any war I could think of in human history, leaders have manipulated populations to go to war. I mean, that's how it happens. Also manipulated other nations to come in and attack so you can go to war. It's not a new phenomenon in war. And I think it was a new revelation because of the Freedom of Information Act that allowed us to understand what happened before World War II, as you wrote about in your book. The other hand, as I was reading that chapter, I kept thinking, but wait a minute. If we hadn't, let's guarantee, we were brought in by a lie, but if we hadn't fought that war and fascism won in Europe, in Asia, the power would be given to fascists in our own country, the racists who were already powerful in the South. I mean, there's a strong argument to be made that while the war was a lie, that what we were facing was an onslaught of a fascistic capitalism worse than the one we faced even at home, unless you were black down south.
Now, when Franklin Roosevelt claimed to have a map of how the Nazis would slice up the Americas, it was a crude forgery of Karl Rove quality. When Roosevelt claimed the Nazis were sinking U.S. ships unprovoked, it was blatant lies. And the idea that fascism was about to take over the globe and we needed to act defensively is pretty untenable. When previous emperors took over Europe, when Napoleon took over Europe, we stayed home. And just as the Nazis did, he lost to the Russians. I mean, all the movies are made about the U.S. going up against the Germans. 80% of their army went and destroyed itself against the Russians. So, you know, give them a little credit as far as the warfare goes. But we did not have to get to that point. We almost had a fascist coup in this country in the 30s, right? We didn't have to have fascism win by taking over France and England in order to have fascism here. We spent the 30s and the 40s with Wall Street financing fascism in Germany, right? We didn't have to do that. We could have financed nonviolent resistance training. We didn't have to put our money into eugenics research in Nazi Germany. And our corporations didn't have to keep working with Nazi Germany through the war. I mean, the hypocrisy is a problem, but the overblown claims of the likelihood of permanent global fascist rule are way overblown. I think there's very little evidence for that, and certainly we didn't have to spend decades going back to how we ended World War I, making it as likely as possible, and avoiding all possibility of negotiation and peace and nonviolent resistance, and focusing on war as the only alternative. It never was the only alternative.
And you're moving into, folks, we'll open the mics here in the audience in about 10 minutes, so get ready to ask your questions and participate in this conversation, please. We look at the Civil War. Hmm. Civil War is another war that you write about intensely in this book. And most people would agree that the Civil War was not, as you wrote, about ending slavery. At least that wasn't on Abraham Lincoln's mind. But clearly it was on the South's mind to keep slavery in place. Almost every declaration of secession had in it, we'll maintain slavery. Slavery is our right. And if you were a slave, whether the South, the North was fighting about slavery, for you, the war was about ending slavery. And in the end, the war did become about that because of the economic and military happenstance of that war. So that's another war I think that Americans have difficulty not thinking about as a just war.
Well, you know, attaching evil descriptions to the other side or benevolent outcomes to your side in a war, during it or after the fact, doesn't mean that the war wasn't the worst way to accomplish those same ends. Right. I mean, we talk about World War II after the fact as saving the Jews when that had nothing to do with it, neither as real motivation or propaganda.
Right.
And when the Civil War began, it was not about ending slavery. It was about preserving the Union. Right. And certainly it was about secession was about preserving slavery. But the North insisting that you cannot secede, that you must go to war, was not about ending slavery. And in fact, it was when Union was no longer a sufficient motivation for Union soldiers to go and kill and die that Abraham Lincoln needed something else. And it was when there was the possibility of European nations coming in on the side of the South that Abraham Lincoln needed something else. And so, of course, he freed the slaves only in those places where he could not free the slaves without winning the war. Not in the border states.
Not Maryland anyway. I mean.
And so looking at global history, most places that ended slavery did it without a war. We did it with a war. Most places that have developed more democratic rule, including our neighbors to the north, done it without the revolution. We think that because something good can be attached to a war, we've justified the war, when we could have accomplished the same ends and perhaps better without the war. Imagine the South had left and we had split up the country, right? Maybe we would still have a country half the size. Maybe that would enable us to get some voices heard in Washington. Our country is too big. But the South would have been isolated. The fugitive slave law wouldn't have lasted a week. And slavery wouldn't have lasted 6 months. You're not going to justify a war by attaching a noble motive to it when you could have accomplished the same thing without the war.
If we look at history, talk about then the places where the things you talk about were accomplished without wars like that. Canada seceded from Britain without war. But when you talk about our human history and the state of war in our human history, which has been constant throughout our civilizations, whatever they're, from Hopi civilization to British civilization, wherever they were, war has been a constant. So where does that fit into the scenario and the analysis of living a world without war?
Well, I disagree fundamentally, and I say so in the book, and I hope I document it. Most human societies have not had war. We have not had warfare back through the ages of human development. For most of our development, we were the prey of animals. When something resembling warfare developed, it was bands hunting animals. It was when we had killed off most of the larger animals and we had unemployable warriors who didn't produce their own food that they started looking at each other as sources of respectable employment. But when we developed complex sedentary societies, some of them had warfare and some of them did not. And many did not, and continents did not, and Australia did not until the white folks came, and parts of our own Southwest did not until the white folks came. And there have been nations that have refused new weapons. There have been nations that have done away with war. There have been nations that have shut down and disbanded their entire militaries and said no more. And today, most nations in the world do not go to war, are very reluctant to go to war. If the wealthy states that we drag into our coalitions of the willing were hungry for war and just refraining because they couldn't win them or due to a Pax Americana, then they would be eager to join these coalitions to go attack some impoverished nation or halfway around the globe that has oil. You know, but they aren't. They aren't. They have to be dragged kicking and screaming. And the source of the worst wars in human history, Europe, is never, again, ever going to be the source of a war. The European Union has unified. It's as likely as Maryland starting a war with Virginia. It's not going to happen. And so, for almost all of war, it was men alone. Now women are part of war, right? Well, if women can get in, why can't men get out, right? If we can have the same exact sorts of incidents that we use to start wars and avoid wars as we did repeatedly through the Cold War, right? Remember Bush telling Blair, "Oh, let's fly some planes low, get U-2 planes shot with UN colors on, and then we'll start a war." Well, when U-2s got shot down by the Soviet Union, we very specifically did not start a war because we didn't want to destroy the planet. And it can be possible to choose not to destroy regions of the planet. And at this point, we're going to have to stop the war machine or we will destroy the planet without nuclear holocaust. So I think, there has been warfare, but nothing like the extent to which 1950s American anthropologists pretended that man the warrior was our history. Right, that Newt Gingrich's story about bringing the giraffe home for dinner is not human history. Right, we look at the walls of Jericho and say, "Oh, those were for war; they were for flooding." We look at Australopithecine bones and we say, "Look at those wounds; they are teeth marks from cats." We were prey. We impose war on other human societies that haven't known it, and in fact, nobody anywhere until the past 50, 60 years has known anything that resembled our current warfare more than it resembled wrestling matches. I mean, modern technological warfare is a completely new thing that is so horrific compared to anything past that you can't say, "Oh, the Greeks got along okay fighting and killing each other." They didn't do anything like what we do to places like Baghdad and Kabul. They just didn't.
One of the things people say in response to the book, I had a conversation about your book the other night in a group that I go to once a month.
Glad to hear it.
Oh, yeah. It was part of the conversation we had. And some of the conversation revolved around, it's true that there have been a lot of societies on the planet Earth until now who may have had warrior societies, like the Hopi, but who were ostensibly peaceful societies.
Well, so are we, no?
But no. No, because the difference is, as Martin Luther King talked about, was we are more concerned with war preparedness than societal preparedness to take care of our people, of our world, of our environment, of our children. And the question came up with, where is the balance? Because we'll never get rid of, for want of a better term, the evil that lurks where it lurks, anywhere in the, because we'll never have a unified planet. So how do we respond to that as societies? How do we respond to the threats that come to us?
Well, the previous question went to the fact that this is not in our genes. It's not inevitable.
It's not in our genes.
And it's not even in the minds of us as Americans. If you survey Americans,
right,
a majority will say, take the money out of that military machine and put it into useful things. Right? It is in our government. It is built into systems of corruption of our government. And it is going to be very, very hard to stop. But that doesn't mean it can't be done. And it doesn't mean we can't have a unified planet. To have a unified planet, part of the planet will have to stop exploiting the rest of the planet, which is a great difference in the states that wage war from the comparison of France and Germany or Maryland and Virginia. We are exploiting other countries, but that will have to stop for environmental reasons as well. And you know, we are going to destroy ourselves in one way or another unless we radically change. And there is no reason we can't. Empires are going to go down one way or another. And we are smart enough, I think, to take this one down the easy way and to recognize that others, including Britain, have been better off when they lost their empire and to hurry up and lose it nonviolently.
So as we open this up, and folks, please, when you want to speak, raise your hand, and Kevin Zeese will pay attention to the audience and find you and have you join in this conversation. So what do you think, then, America does, Americans do? Your voice, whether people agree completely with what David Swanson says or not, or they didn't agree with what the Berrigan said completely or not, who I think are some of the angels of the planet in my book. Those voices aren't heard. The other voice is heard all the time. So somehow, the debate for the conscience of America has to be able to get its voice out to change the discussion, to alter the discussion.
Well, we haven't completely lost
No, we have not. I'm not saying that.
Right, but we haven't lost our voice, I think, to the extent that we tend to imagine. Right, I mean, when George W. Bush says in his book that in 2006 Mitch McConnell came privately and said, get the troops out of Iraq
right.
before the election,
right.
and we were running around telling each other that all was hopeless and why should we have another march because we had a march last year and it didn't end the war. You know, the fact that our voice was, you know, an inch away from winning is important to know. And certainly
yeah.
we need a decent democratic small-d communication system. We need to support shows like yours, media outlets like Free Speech TV, and all of the thousands of good ones that are growing, and stop using and stop buying ads in and stop giving any respectability to the corporate media outlets that are driving the war machine and destroying this world. And I think when we come to that understanding and we invest in communication to the extent that we need to the extent that everybody outside of the North American liberal has done already, we will have our voices heard. But we have majority opinion despite the communication system. We're down to 34% of Americans supporting the war in Afghanistan.
Right.
We just need the understanding to be deeper, to understand that this wasn't a war that we messed up somehow. It should have been run better. That war is the most serious crime and always will be every war, so that we can stop the machinery that is already ginning up the next ones.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're here this evening with David Swanson, who has written the book War is a Lie. Hi, we are broadcasting for the Mark Steiner Show, the Center for Emerging Media for Free Speech TV, down here at 5th and K at Bus Boys and Poets. And we're here with a live audience, and we welcome all of you as well. And let you know, we have a roving mic in the audience, so you can participate in this conversation, because we want you involved in this. Kevin, you have folks in the audience who want to speak with us?
Approximately 2 weeks before invading Afghanistan, President Bush issued a statement where he gave Mullah Omar an ultimatum to turn bin Laden over, and he refused to do so. And I agree with some of your points that you're making right now as far as peace and war criminals and things of that nature, but I clearly recall on several different occasions the UN, as well as President Bush, directing the Taliban to turn Osama bin Laden over. And they basically told us to go to hell.
Well, no, they didn't. At first, they said, we want to see some evidence, some prima facie evidence of guilt. We want assurance that the death penalty will not be used. And we want to turn him over to a third neutral country. But as the bombing loomed, they dropped some of those conditions and said, we will turn him over to a third country, period. And George W. Bush said, not interested, we're going to war. But let's assume that what you said is what happened. There is still absolutely no moral, rational, or legal justification for having gone to war. You do not bomb a population of a nation because some rulers of that nation have refused to turn a prisoner over to be put on trial. That is the committing the most serious crime there is on the excuse that a much lesser crime has been committed, right? There was a survey done a couple of months ago in which over 90% of Afghans in the southern provinces could tell you what 9/11 was. They haven't heard about it. They don't know what it is. And yet, we're dropping missiles through their roofs. We're kicking in their doors. We're shooting them at checkpoints because somebody did something and we have to get back at them, right? Revenge has never been a legal justification for war. I certainly hope never will be. And it's a rather primitive emotion. That's all it is. And so when a nation needs to turn someone over, as we need to turn 27 agents of the CIA over to Italy, where they've been convicted of kidnapping to torture, it doesn't justify Italy bombing Washington. It justifies Italy using what diplomatic nonviolent tools they can to pressure Washington. And they aren't attempting that at all, but they could.
Just to follow up on what he was saying, and then we'll go to the very next person in the audience. I was really fascinated by that part of your book, and I recalled it because we covered on our program the impending wars from 2001 on, and Andy Shalal was actually a guest on a couple of shows back in those days. And I was rereading a lot of the articles around Europe just to get the underpinnings of what you wrote in your book this morning. And some people argue that part of it was also part of a grave diplomatic game being played between the Taliban and the United States. It's not all on the U.S. side in terms of playing shenanigans around bin Laden, but that the U.S. also wanted to go to war and were incapable of reading the signs of what the Pashtun were saying. As Pashtun have said to me, they didn't understand, I think the word is abra, abra, which means to the Pashtun that you have to give me some room. I'm giving you this story. You have to understand what I'm telling you so you can go around here and do what you have to do. I'm saying Osama is not here. He's hiding, which means I don't know where he is. You get him if you want him. There were a lot of games were being played back then, but clearly we didn't. But even if we had played that game, to get bin Laden would have taken some force.
But understand that it's the wrong question if the question is should we have a war or not, right? Just as does Iraq have weapons of mass destruction or not was the wrong frame for should we go to war or not. You right. Can't go to war because somebody has some weapons, right? But that became the question. So should we go to war if the Taliban is cooperating with us on bin Laden or not is the wrong question. It doesn't justify going to war. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the ignorance is the main characteristic of everything we've been doing. We've learned in the past year, we've been holding meetings with a leader of the Taliban who's not a member of the Taliban.
Right. Made a lot of money at it, but it wasn't right. I mean, but bin Laden did, Al-Qaeda did attack the United States of America. He did attack. They did attack America. So America has to have... Well, we can argue that, too. But I would argue that.
As with Bradley Manning, we say alleged until we at least put them on trial. We apparently have no interest in putting them on trial, so we're going to have to say alleged forever.
Well, I think their statements have been pretty clear that they've taped and said back what they've done. I mean, I don't think there's... In my mind, there's not much doubt.
I don't think there's much question either. But
so the question is, how does a country address that? Clearly, attacking Afghanistan, killing thousands of Afghan people, creating a whole posturing resistance in two worlds is not the way to resolve that issue.
No.
How do you resolve it?
Well, when the World Trade Center was bombed the first time, we put people on trial, convicted them, put them in prison. When our own homegrown terrorists attack Oklahoma City, we don't bomb Oklahoma and then go bomb Oregon for good measure. We put them on trial. We treat a crime as a crime. So whether it's a fair analogy or not, when you have a crime, you should treat it as a crime, not as an excuse for a war. Bear in mind that before we went into Afghanistan, George W. Bush had already said to Tony Blair, okay, we'll go into Afghanistan, but then we're going into Iraq. Right? Within hours of 9/11 crimes, we were talking about our president and his underlings were talking about a war on Iraq, whether or not Iraq had any connection to it or not. Right, so this was an opportunity for war. That was what it was viewed as. That was what it was used as.
We have somebody else, Kevin, out there, wants to ask a question.
My name's Jake. I'm an Afghanistan and Iraq vet, and David and some of you folks in here are friends. My question is, if you look at the world today, there is a movement within the world of civil unrest. For instance, I was in Lebanon this last summer, working with Iraqi refugees that are sitting inside of Lebanon, and there's all sorts of anti-Israeli movements, there's anti-American movements, there's intra-Lebanese movements, and this is taking place in Sri Lanka, Turkey, Yemen, all sorts of places. I mean, there's what David Kilcullen calls an inter-global insurgency amongst failed and corruption inside its failed states. Now, David, I'm curious, whether war is a lie or not, I mean, you can have that debate, but I'm curious, are you interested in the United States not being involved in this intra-global level of violence at all? I mean, should we just become isolationists? Or is there a way to get involved that would somewhat involve the military, or not at all? I mean, what would you say to the folks in this room and abroad about what it means of looking at this reality that there is global violence that's occurring?
Well, after 9/11, there were various proposals for what to do. Shirin Ebadi, a Nobel Peace Prize winner from Iran, said that the United States ought to build an elementary school in Afghanistan, each one named for a victim of 9/11. That would not have been isolationism. It would have just been a very different form of involvement with other people, very, very different from dropping bombs and kicking in doors. I think when you look at what's come out through WikiLeaks, and I hope that the rest continues to come out, I don't see anything more valuable happening, including in its impact in places like Tunisia. I think what you see the U.S. doing is backing thugs, backing dictators, backing military coups in places like Honduras, taking advice on illegal wars from royalty and dictators, and functioning in terms of its diplomatic corps primarily as assistant weapons salesmen and women for U.S. weapons companies. We are arming nations who are fighting each other with both sides supplied by U.S. weapons makers. We are potentially arming Saudi Arabia in a way never before seen so that they can hold off the threat of Iran's U.S.-made weapons. We are not a helpful influence on the world. And the alternative is not to bury your head in the sand. The alternative is to start relating to the world without the hostility, the distrust, the manipulation, the illegal spying, and the idea that other countries function primarily to buy our weapons. I think we should work with the world as partners. We should work with the world as friends. We should develop relationships that involve shared resources and nonviolent opportunities for shared connections. I don't think most Americans want isolation. It's just that we've come to this very exceptionalist view where it's our right to impose things on the rest of the world for their own good, whether they like it or not, including occupations, which we would never stand for ourselves.
We have a question back here, one up here. Let's go to the question back there first, and we'll see how much more time we have.
Of Bradley Manning, who's been in solitary confinement now to the point where he may have permanent brain damage. Do you see it as a good sign that the government is so upset about WikiLeaks? Do you think we're, like you mentioned the previous time when we were just that close to maybe changing government policy, do you think their fearfulness of WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning and other people like that shows that the government knows how close they are to being pushed by public opinion to change their direction?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right that they are terrified of information. When you have Congressman Peter King saying that what WikiLeaks has done, that is, give newspapers some information on what the U.S. government is doing, is worse than being bombed, it illustrates that their irrationality, what they are afraid of and what they're not. You know, they would rather have our cities be bombed than have us know what our government is doing, right? And so putting out information about what our government is doing is an incredible threat to them. And now potentially putting out information about what very wealthy individuals are doing, their crimes and their evasions, is very, very threatening to these people. They do not want us to know. They know that knowledge is power. And yet you have a disturbing number of Americans who believe that ignorance is strength, that we should punish the people who are trying to tell us what our government is doing, rather than going and reading the information and realizing that we have had dozens and dozens of the most extreme crimes and abuses exposed and confirmed. Wars in places like Pakistan and Yemen and the lies about them from multiple countries. The pressure put on European nations to not investigate and prosecute our crimes and so forth. Americans ought to know these things. We cannot have a representative government without knowing these things, but they don't want us to have a representative government. They are afraid of the very same things that the elites in this country and others have been afraid of for centuries. Majority rule, democracy. They're terrified of it.
My question, if you want one, is I think I'd like to see what you think about the idea that to say that we have to have a military means that we have to have this military, or whether the military itself is part of the problem and how it's structured.
Well, I appreciate all of those comments, which are very well said, which your comments always are, John. And I, as you know, agree with you on many ways in which the military could be different. You know, typically, a volunteer organization is one that you can quit. This military is not that. This military is much too large. It is trained for the wrong things, but I don't want it trained for disaster relief and humanitarian aid, which serves often as an excuse to get our troops into places they otherwise couldn't get into. I want a different institution trained and given the resources to do the work around the world that we should be doing.
In the middle, and then over here.
I think a pretty good follow-on to what you just were talking about. We were talking recently about conversion and how some years ago our military started converting bases to other uses and they started decommissioning bases and other things like that. And I know I've heard since I've been in D.C. the last few days there's an Institute of Peace that's been established. I don't know what their mission is exactly, But I guess my question is there something within the military or within the government that is looking for ways to redirect our military dollars to peacetime uses? Because there's certainly a lot of need for that. We are destroying the environment with our military. It's the biggest polluter in the world. And we are destroying humanity with our military. As we've said, mostly it's civilians who are being killed, including a lot of innocent children. So we have to turn this around, and I think it's got to come from within, perhaps the military itself. There's people in the military who don't like the direction things are going. I'm hoping that's the case. If you have any comments on that, thank you.
Well, Bradley Manning is a member of our military. There are people in the military who have the right ideas in their heads. There are an increasing number of soldiers refusing illegal orders to fight. There are GI coffee shops growing up around bases that are assisting in that work. Iraq Veterans Against the War is working with active soldiers, in particular those who have PTSD, to resist being sent back into war until they have a chance to recover a little mentally from the last bout they experienced. I think we shouldn't think of the military as a uniform block in terms of its members. There is somebody in the State Department who has decided they should promote and show a film about Dan Ellsberg now. I think there are people in the government who have the right ideas and become whistleblowers and resistors, and we should reach out to them. But I don't want the military turned into a force for good. I want it dramatically reduced in existence.
My question is, how do we enforce the rule of law? And we have fantastic laws. The Constitution provides for defense. The National Guard is supposed to repel invasions. We raise armies. We do not keep standing armies. That's what the Constitution requires. We have great treaties. So how do we get this rule of law enforced where we have these great laws enforced and end all the wars?
Good question.
Well, I know the questioner, and he has as many good answers to that question as I do, and a lot of my answers are in my previous book, Daybreak. But I think that anyone who wants organizationally or individually to be part of an effort, be in the strategic planning stages at the moment, to really start working with Spaniards and reaching out to thank and encourage Spain for enforcing the laws we won't enforce ourselves, should contact me. I'm not saying give up entirely on any hope for our own government, but I think the time is right for some outreach to Spanish-speaking people in our own country and everywhere else, but in particular to the Spanish government, to encourage them and to oppose the messages that are now public that they have been getting from our government, encouraging them not to enforce international laws.
David Swanson, thank you so much, A, for the book, because I think War is a Lie is, I encourage everyone who watches or listens to our show to read this book, to wrestle with it, as you would any good text, to think about what we're doing and what you're telling us that we're doing, and the analysis that you bring to this, and the passion you bring to your work, and the fact that you are one of those men who doesn't just write books, one of those people who doesn't write books, but you put your body on the line to stand up for what you believe. So thank you.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.